You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the enormous pleasure, honor, in fact, of speaking with Bill Ayers. Excuse me. You may know that name, you may not. If you're of my vintage from the United States, you certainly do. Little bit of a bio. William Ayers, Distinguished Professor of Education and Senior University Scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago, now retired, has written extensively about social justice and democracy, education, and the cultural context of schooling and education as an essentially intellectual, ethical, and political enterprise. I must say, although not laid out in particular in this brief bio, Bill Ayers' name first appeared in the public eye during the protest, the anti-war, anti-Vietnam War protests of times past, of the 70s, early 70s. Bill was one of the active, perhaps one of the founding members of what was called the Weather Underground. And hopefully we will speak some about that. But it is my great pleasure to have Bill Ayers as a guest today. Bill Ayers, thank you so much for doing this. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. Because doesn't everybody have a podcast these days?
I appreciate being here, David, and thank you for having me. But when you say that, one of my granddaughters said to me the other day, every grown-up man I know has a podcast.
Exactly.
And I said, yes, they're proliferating like weeds.
Yes.
And yet I'm a huge believer in, you know, creating the public square, and it has to be created again and again and again. And
absolutely,
in today's world, podcasts are one of the tools of democratic participation.
Well, so it's pretty cool. That part's pretty cool.
It is cool. And you know, the thing about a classroom, and this is, again, we're kind of plunging into the modern predicament or naming the political moment. But one of the problems with classrooms today is you can feel the eclipse of the public. You can feel the shutting down of dialogue. And it's not only the kind of Neanderthal legislation that's passing here and there, it's the sense of fear that generates. You know,
yes,
I always feel that when the powerful attack Susan Sontag or Aaron Magruder or, you know, Edward Said, it impacts them, but not majorly.
No,
what really impacts is that history teacher in Kansas or that fourth grade teacher in Montana. I mean, if they can go after Susan Sontag, what chance do I have, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So let's start with like what's a nice Chicago boy like you doing in a place like that?
Like which?
How'd you get? So I know the story because you've written about it, because it's been written about. You know, you grew up in a suburban neighborhood in Chicago, went to public schools, and except for the end when you graduated from whatever it was, Lake Forest, I guess, and then went off to college and were inspired to become active. During the Vietnam War days,
right?
And inspired to become active, and you did. You became active.
I did. Yeah.
In a way that is, well, you know, it's a big choice, right? Like a lot of people became active. I was active, I think, but you were active in a way that was really, that put you in the public light, in the public eye, because because it involved, because you were, I don't know if you were the founder or the founding member or a founding member of, if there are such things of the Weather Underground.
Sure.
And it involved vandalism with bombs and really, really getting in the way of things as normal continuing. So how'd that happen?
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question. Let's go back though a little bit further.
Good.
You know, one of the things that I think is one of the problems we face as people who look at and consume news or the media is the news is not the news. It's just happenings. And so, you know, you can go to something like an event, a train wreck or a bombing, and that becomes a happening that gets reported. But there's always a prehistory. There's always a deeper way to look at things. So let me go back a little bit, even beyond where you started. Yes, I grew up in enormous privilege in a suburb of Chicago. My father was the chairman of the board for 30 years of the electric monopoly in Chicago, Commonwealth Edison. I was the middle of five kids, and it was the 1950s, so the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up at the peak of prosperity in this country, the peak of oil, you know, the peak of a kind of a sense of sleepwalking through, you know, the garden for where I lived. And sure. I went away to prep school when I was 16 years old. And
It was a boarding school.
And I was sent there in part because I was kind of a juvenile delinquent for the suburbs. I shot pool and smoked cigarettes and didn't much care about school. So my parents were concerned about me and they thought I ought to go away to school. And since my older brother and my girlfriend were going away to college, I acceded and I said, fine, I'll do that. And so I went away to Lake Forest Academy and I was there for a short time when, as you know, as you say, the Vietnam War was one thing, but long before that, the Black Freedom Movement penetrated even the walls of Lake Forest Academy, because while we were there in our little cushy, you know, garden with the high walls, the reality was seeping through. And that reality was so strong, it was so powerful in terms of naming a moral issue that mattered. And so all the kind of shibboleths that somebody like me had grown up with, you know, all people are equal and we should be kind to our neighbors, was all breaking down in my consciousness, even at 17, 18 years old. Then I went off to Michigan, where I got involved quickly in the civil rights movement. And then the Vietnam War blew up. And I really, really had my eyes opened very quickly. And so from living the deep American sleep of denial, suddenly my eyes are opening up. I've left the country. I've seen something different. The Black Freedom Movement is penetrating everywhere and raising moral alarm bells. And then the Vietnam War. So I came back to Ann Arbor and I fell in with a group of kids who were studying the war, interested in politics. I came from a completely apolitical background, but I was learning very, very quickly. And tried to get the faculty to do a strike, to take one day and go on strike against the war. And the faculty had a meeting about it and said, no, faculty don't strike. We're not going to do a strike, but we will have a day where we focus on Vietnam. So we organized what was then the first teach-in in history at the University of Michigan, a teach-in about Vietnam. It was stunning, staggering for me, because I was, you know, opening my eyes to the world for the first time and blinking uneasily into the brightness, you know. Mm-hmm. But what I remember most clearly from that weekend was the head of Students for a Democratic Society, who was maybe 5 or 6 years older than me, gave a talk in a small auditorium. And he said in that talk, at the end of the talk, he said, I want to say to you undergraduates, don't let your life make a mockery of your values. And that phrase not only hit me between the eyes, but it has stayed with me ever since. Don't let your life make a mockery of your values. You know, I couldn't get it out of my mind. Yeah, and it's still there. And it's still alive. So it's 1965.
Well, you're back in college now? No.
I did go back to college. I limped through college, barely graduated. But I was a student and I was a full-time organizer for Students for a Democratic Society at the same time. And there are other things that happened there. I mean, in that same period, I became a community organizer in Cleveland for 6 months and knocked on doors in the Black community and organized a welfare rights march.
Was that a role you easily stepped into, or was it, did you have to overcome something to like, Jesus Christ, I got to organize?
I can give you an example of what had to be overcome. But in terms of that particular thing of being a community organizer, I was part of a group that was a joint project of Students for a Democratic Society and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Right.
And we were a community. And one of the things that makes activism possible is community.
Yes.
You act not because you're a heroic individual, but because you draw strength from the group. I mean, one of the things that everybody knows, but I think its significance is downplayed. Before we went out to organize, before we went in action, we always had a meeting. And at the meeting, we always sang. And why did we sing? It built community. It built courage. I wouldn't have the courage to do half the things I did if it were just me facing the man. But if it was me and my community determining that this mattered, that if we did this, life could change, that we could make a better world, that another world was in view if we could just push hard enough and organize enough people and so on. But in any case, 1965. And then 3 years later, 1968, now an amazing 55% of people are opposed to the war. Something happened in those 3 years.
Yeah.
And I think that you could select many things that happened, but I'll point to three. One, the Black Freedom Movement came out, not unanimously, but powerfully against the war. A second element is GIs coming home and telling the truth about the war. And this always undermines the war makers, no matter what country you're in. I mean, if you're out there making war and trying to conquer another country, demoralization will set in. It was astonishing. And the country was shaken to its core. The third thing that happened is people like me became organizers against the war. Now, I think that's the least significant of the three I've mentioned, but nonetheless, it was important to me. It was remarkable in terms of just seeing close in what people really think and how people really react. So all those things happened. Now we get up to the spring of 1968 and a majority of people opposed the war. So at the end of March 1968, Lyndon Johnson, who was the most effective politician, you know, of his generation, Lyndon Johnson announced us that he will not run for re-election to the presidency. He will instead end the war. Well, we were ecstatic. I mean, those of us who'd spent 3 years trying to, I mean, now the war was going to end, and we couldn't have been happier. We rallied all over the country. There were rallies, but in Ann Arbor, a group of us swirled around the town and landed on the president of the University of Michigan steps. And he came out with a bullhorn, and I had a bullhorn. He was the president of the university. I was the president of the student group, and we bullhorned back and forth. And he said that night something that I believed when he said it, and I think he believed it too. He said, "Congratulations, you've won a great victory. Now the war will end." 5 days later, King was assassinated. 2 months later, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. And 3 months after that, Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon ascended to power. And suddenly the war not only would not end, it would expand into Laos and Cambodia. And all of our efforts seemed wasted, seemed undone, seemed defeated. And at that point, that was a crisis both for democracy and for the anti-war movement and for Students for a Democratic Society and for me.
I was about to say, people, for you personally. Yeah.
You know, a crisis for me personally. And nobody actually knew what to do, but it led to some very serious debates and discussions. I became part of a small group who started what we thought of as a clandestine organization that could do two things. One is that it could survive the onslaught of what we saw was a an incipient American fascism. And secondly, we could take the war to the war makers. And that was called the Weather Underground. But none of us were victorious. We didn't end the war. Mm-hmm. None of us in America ended the war. And that's, I think, part of our great shame. And again, to go back a little further, if you think of what we hoped to do in 1963, 64, 65, we hoped to put an end once and for all to racism and white supremacy. We hoped once and for all to not only end the war in Vietnam, but to end the underlying causes of war. And now we are 60 years later and we look at it and we say, holy crap, white supremacy is a deep American monster that's, it's like a hydra. You cut off one head and another head springs up. And the same is true of war. You know,
I just wanted to, because you didn't say it, but it feels like it needs to be said that it's, well, so did you bring an end to the war? No, but you did push against the idea that your values, you were making a mockery of your values.
Well, I tried to. Siblings. Well, we tried to. And you know, I would say this, you know, actually, one of our granddaughters, our 14-year-old granddaughter, said the other day, she was being a little bit disgusted with the state of the world. And she said, well, at least you guys tried. And I said, put that on my tombstone. He tried. He failed miserably, but he kept trying. But I would say this about, first of all, I would say that when people say, for example, and it has been said, that SDS or the Weather Underground or this group or the mobilization didn't shorten the war by 10 minutes, that may be true. But I think it's too easy, and it's an American way of thinking, to think that everything has an instantaneous cause and effect. No, we don't know what little actions lead to what bigger actions. History is a giant swirling vortex.
It is.
We're in it.
It's such a web. Yes, yeah, I mean, I'm glad you said that because it sounded like you were painting the picture that what you did was, you know, was that. And, you know, that's what makes, I mean, with, look, yes, a blizzard is more than just a bunch of snowflakes.
Exactly.
But without the snowflakes, there is no blizzard, no matter
that's
what.
Exactly right. And I think that's a great image, because in Chicago, which is my hometown and where I do all my political work, and I think it is an important hub of so many movements. But I can point to you to this failed project and that failed project and this failed project, and eventually a victory that no one expected. And each of those little things that changed consciousness, that changed the narrative, that changed the way people thought about something. So you can't say, how is this going to lead to that? And I want to give you one other example that just popped into my head. When Bernadine and I and our kids moved to Chicago from New York, back to Chicago from New York, Illinois had just reinstated the death penalty. So Illinois had been free of the death penalty for decades, and now we're going to start killing people again. And the state of Illinois decided in its wisdom to kill a person named John Wayne Gacy, who is well known. Of course, you say, oh yeah, everybody knows the name. Nobody can draw a map of Ukraine, but everybody
That's
knows
right,
who
exactly.
John Wayne Gacy is. In any case,
John Wayne Gacy.
Oh yeah, everybody knows him. And in any case, they decided they were going to kill him. And Bernadine and I were not part of the anti-death penalty movement in any organized sense. I mean, instinctively we were against it. But so we listened to the radio and to popular culture just getting more and more celebratory. We're going to kill the monster. We're going to kill him. And we were so disgusted, each of us, that we drew straws, and one of us, and I won. So Bernadine stayed home, put the kids to bed, and I drove down to Stateville to protest the killing of John Wayne Gacy. I didn't go with anybody else. I went by myself. I had a little sign that said, "Thou shalt not kill." And I showed up at the prison. I had to park a mile away because there were thousands of teenagers with a beer and boom boxes ready to celebrate when the lights went off and Gacy was killed. I made my way to the front of the prison. There were 9 elderly nuns holding candles, 2 lawyers and me. And we sat there singing freedom songs and so on. And when they did kill him, and the crowd cheered, and we left, And if I've ever felt marginal in my life, and I have, that's as marginal as it gets. But the thing to remember, two things to remember. One is, when I went down there, I wasn't going down with the calculus of I will win.
Right.
You know, Gacy was for sure going to be executed. I wasn't going to win anything by staying. But I also had the calculus that I wanted to know who I was as a human being. And I'm a human being who wants to stand against the state murdering somebody who's already been disabled and is no threat to anyone. I want to stand against that. So it was an existential desire, or don't let your life make a mockery of your values. It wasn't the calculus of success. Not that I think we shouldn't have a calculus of success, but you see my point. Yeah. But here's the other interesting thing. One of the lawyers I was standing with that night was Bernadine's next door neighbor at the law school. He won the first wrongful conviction suit 3 years later. And 6 years later, Illinois abolished the death penalty because the movement really was built. And it's a most astonishing story. We did abolish the death penalty, not because of what I did, but because that's the way history moves.
Because that's the
fire
way
from below.
Absolutely.
You have to name the obstacles to your humanity.
Absolutely.
And you have to act on that.
And it's the other thing that, you know, it's been said before. I think I heard it from Howard Zinn years ago, but you know, that you never know. You never know what the next moment brings. So, you know, the moment before the kids walked into the lunch counter and sat down, you know, the day before, Black people were walking down the street and averting their eyes and being polite to the white people, just like, and the next day, right? So who would have predicted it? Nobody, right?
Nobody. And that's important to know for living today, because the day before any revolution, it's impossible.
It's impossible.
And the day after, it's inevitable. And the way Antonio Gramsci said it is, be a pessimist of the head, but an optimist of the heart. Mm. And that's a good dialectic. You know too much to be an optimist, but you hope too much to be a pessimist.
Right.
And so we kind of buy into the idea that hope is a politics, that you can choose hope. And since we don't know what's coming, and that's your point, the day before Rosa Parks sat in, nobody saw it coming. And then, holy shit, there it was. So you act, you know, and I would say one other thing about that, which is in every age, in every history, in every country, anywhere, there are people who can imagine a world that could be otherwise. There are always people who can imagine that we could have a fairer, more just, more balanced, more peaceful world. And then they work toward that. And that's what makes us interesting as a species.
So can we, I'm not sure we're switching lanes here, but how do you get from being a guy who's standing against the war in big and violent, although not necessarily against human beings in any way, but way to a guy who's thinking about, first of all, running a preschool and then thinking about education and how do you get to be that guy? And is it the same thing? Is there a link?
It is. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting because, you know, it's easy to take a public person, any public person, and I'm certainly not, I'm a little bit notorious, but I mean, any public person, you can take an isolated moment and say, how does this fit with that? But in reality, we tend to live a life that has its own kind of rhythm and integrity. And the dance, the dialectical dance between choice and chance is happening to us all the time, each of us. We didn't choose our parents. We were thrust into the world. We begin to choose who we want to be. Other things happen. We get in an accident, we get an illness, whatever. These things happen, you know, and yet you choose and how you invent yourself as a human being is the choices you make. And so I chose to be against the war. I chose to make that a vocation. And that led me step by step toward, you know, toward more serious, more urgent confrontations with power. But I became a teacher in 1965, and I became a teacher because in that first arrest I described a few minutes ago, I was in jail, in the county jail, Washtenaw County, Ann Arbor County Jail. Ann Arbor was called one of the great American cities. And I kept thinking, yeah, the all-American jail in the great American city. In any case, I learned a lot in jail, and I was put in isolation, and, you know, the humiliation that goes with it was just crazy. But I met some people in the jail who had just started a freedom school. And I went out of jail, and I walked over to the basement of the Quaker Center, and into this place. I was 20 years old. I never thought of being a teacher, and they absolutely captured me. And I went back again and again, and within 18 months, I was the director of the school. So, you know, it was a little do-it-yourself, ready-made, handmade kind of part of the social movement of the time. Our little school was dedicated to integration, racial integration as a principle. We were dedicated to respecting children as full human beings, not as little adjuncts who had to be, you know, made into human beings.
It was a preschool. It was a preschool, right?
It was a preschool initially, and then began to grow. But yeah, and we accepted the fact that that every child is both the one of one and one of the many. And we tried to create an environment where that was honored. So here's why I tell you that, because I went out of jail into my first teaching position. And for me, teaching and social justice have never been something you have to figure out how to combine. For me, it was organic. Now, that's not true for everybody, but it certainly felt true to me. And I think of education at its best as a project of enlightenment and liberation. People need to know more to be able to do more. And we do more collectively. And we try to name the obstacles to our humanity and do something about it. So I found myself as a teacher and as an activist following the same rhythm. The rhythm of teaching and activism and good citizenship and moral behavior always involves opening your eyes, seeing who's there and what's there, paying attention, and then being astonished at the creativity, the ingenuity, the integrity, all the beautiful, joyful things that human beings create, and also astonished at the unnecessary suffering that we visit upon one another. And then you have to act. And once you act, you have to doubt. You have to say, was it all that good? What did I do? And then repeat for a lifetime. Pay attention, open your eyes, be astonished, act, doubt, repeat. And I do that as a teacher. I do that as an activist. And it's not easy, but it is, to me, the path that allows us to make the best contributions we're capable of making to the group, to the collective, to the social. I got my doctorate when I was 43 years old. So I was a late bloomer in the academic world. I got my first academic job at 43. But when I interviewed, yes, people asked me weird questions. I mean, it wasn't that I wasn't prepared for them, but because I've been living this life, but you know, the first interview I went on for a job at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, the first question was, I see there's a gap in your resume of 12 years. Where were you? And, because I'd published articles on education 12 years ago, and then I'd published articles on education here. Where were you? And I knew enough not to lie about it. I wasn't going to pretend I was somebody I wasn't. And that answer was completely acceptable to people. I mean, some people really thought that I was terrible. Some people just wanted to forget about the war and move on. Some people felt that if I could make a contribution as a scholar and an academic and a teacher, fine, that's all that counted. And some people felt that what I had done was courageous and brave and good. So, you know, it was a division of how people saw it. But I would say, it never really got in my way. The question for university folks is, are you producing? Are you doing the work that you're supposed to do? And I was. And so I went from being an assistant professor in 1987 to being, you know, a distinguished professor and university scholar 15 years later, you know, because I did the work. But the work that I did was also deeply political work. That is to say, I was fighting for against racism in the schools, against the white supremacist school system, for the opportunities for kids who've been kicked to the curb to actually have a voice and a way. And I found ways to use that work with institutional support to have a larger voice than I might have had. So I feel very lucky.
Who are you teaching to? Was it kids who wanted to be teachers?
When I first started at the University of Illinois at Chicago, my students were all folks who were becoming teachers. That's how it began. And then I began teaching graduate students as well. So most of my students were first generation. Most of their parents were carpenters and plumbers and police officers and firefighters and nurses. That's the population that I taught. And when I came to UIC, this is just another thing that shows the way that all these political things mix in. I came to UIC and I asked them, how many of your graduates last year went into the Chicago public schools? And they said, none. And I said, how is it possible that the premier public university in Chicago, in Illinois, sent nobody into the public schools, even though you've trained them as teachers? And so the first thing I did in my first class was I said, we're going to each do an internship in a public school. And I spent a lot of time finding folks in the public schools who I admired and sending my kids out. And when I made this as part of the assignment, I also had them do an internship in a community organization in the neighborhood where the school was. It was just comical, and it was so Chicago. I had made this assignment, and I got one kid came to me and said, my dad said I can't go into that neighborhood unless I'm in the front seat of his squad car. And another, I had a captain, a precinct captain. Chicago is this political system. I had a precinct captain call me and say, I understand you made this assignment, and my niece is one of the people in your class, and I'm not going to let her go into that school. So I had some pushback, but the interesting thing is that 5 years later, 8 years later, every kid graduating from our program went into a Chicago public school, because it was something that was such a glaring, ridiculous contradiction. Somebody had to come and break down that wall. And that's what I decided I wanted to do. And it was, it was very rewarding. But see, that goes to the first point about my rhythm of activism or teaching. If you don't open your eyes, how the hell do you know what's out there?
Yeah.
How do you know how to act? And these kids have been intentionally blinded, intentionally made mute. And suddenly somebody came along and said, take the blindfold off. Go ahead. These are people. I had an assignment. I remember this is all coming back to me, but I remember I had an assignment where when you first went to the school, you had to do a neighborhood survey. Where do people do their laundry? Where do people get their groceries? Is it a food desert? I mean, I had all of these questions, and the kids would kind of freak out at first, and then in groups of two and three, take a trip around the neighborhood and find out that real people live there with kids and elders and tasks and jobs and things that have to be done. And I think that on the one hand, as I say it, it seems so simple and so simple-minded. But on the other hand, it was profound in a certain way.
So where did you feel most effective?
Effectiveness is a funny word because I would say that, I think that teachers, me for sure, have a kind of a genetic problem, which is we don't need much praise to keep going.
I tell teachers all the time, we all live on crumbs. We live on crumbs. You remember when you said that thing in class? It's like, no, I don't.
Exactly.
Damn it. I'm so glad you said that. And then I could go for another 3 years.
You're exactly right. That's exactly what I was going to say. I like the image of crumbs, but I get, if somebody comes to me once in 5 years and said, you made a difference. And I say to them, was it positive? And they say, yes, you made a positive difference. I say, man, I can go another 5 or 10 years, with that one little thing. But we operate on faith, and faith, is the evidence of things unseen.
Yeah.
And teachers are very much operating on faith. We put it out there. We do our best. We listen hard. We get into dialogue. The best teachers are always in dialogue, listening with the possibility of being changed, speaking with the possibility of being heard, but not just speaking, also listening and changing. And we have faith that somehow that could make a difference in people's lives. So, well, we teachers may not change the world. We might, in fact, change the people who will change the world.
Yeah.
And that's what always keeps me going.
I'm completely there. I used to want to push. I did push harder on teachers to, you know, we all have said it, right? We're just planting seeds. We're planting seeds.
Right.
And especially, you know, you're asking people to do all these things. And it's like you're eating up their lives. You're eating up their time. So can't we do better than just,
right.
Can we do better than just sort of convince ourselves that we're actually planting seeds? Can we try to sort of tease out, how do you know? And the perfect example that you just gave was the change from nobody's working in the public schools to everybody's right. working in the public
right.
schools.
So that's a satisfying feeling, but
yeah.
But I must say that the other thing that I mentioned, this thing about demonstrating against the state murdering John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah.
There's something really, really, really satisfying and really energizing about working together with other people to try yes. to bring a more just, a more balanced world into being. And you can get so much sustenance from that. You know, I often think that the dialectic of not burning out involves remembering that you're not alone, that you're one of the many. You are the one of one. There's nobody like you, but you're also one of the many. And if you can work with other people to put a little shoulder on the wheel, that could be really, really important. And so that's what, you know, I think there's something very satisfying about working with others. You also have to care for yourself and love your own life. And it's the kind of balance between loving your own life and loving the world that you try to work out in practice. If you just love your own life, you're a narcissist. If you just love the world, you know, you're an ant on the anthill. You don't want to be an ant on the anthill, but nor do you want to be, you know, some kind of narcissistic, self-feeding monster. So it's that the trick is to kind of find people who are in that world, in that like-minded space, and move forward. And from, you know, my students often would say to me, you know, I'm now teaching in 3 universities. I'll tell you about that. But
I was about to ask that question.
Yeah, yeah, my You're students say to me, you know, well, you know, Bill, I can't do everything. And my response is always, can you do anything? Because anything is where it starts. Nobody can do everything, but you can start somewhere. And Bernadine has told her students over many years, her law students, you know, get involved in something. Do you care about human rights, queer rights, women's rights? Do you care about war and peace? Do you care about white supremacy? Get involved in something. Apprentice yourself to someone. And then, you know, you'll find the next step by being involved in that work. And that, I feel that's very important. So I don't buy the argument that because I can't do anything, I don't do anything.
Well, that's the.
I mean, because I can't do everything, I don't do anything.
Unless I can figure out how, you know, I'm going to feed all the people in New York City. There's no,
exactly.
There's no chance, right? There's no sense to it. It's like.
Well, I had this great discussion in my ethics class about. My prompt was, "What do you owe to an approximate stranger?" And the range of answers to that were approximate stranger in distress. And the range of answers were incredible, because some people, you know, I give money to people who ask for it, blah, blah, blah. And other people were, no, you're just encouraging them to buy drugs. And somebody said, I'm only responsible for my family. And so we got into a whole long discussion about the contract of mutual indifference. If you see somebody get hit by a car and you don't think that's your responsibility, then when you get hit by a car, that's nobody's responsibility either. And you know, so, and then we changed the prompt from what do you owe approximate stranger to what do we owe approximate stranger? And now we're talking about social ethics and what we can decide together. And it's really an exciting thing to watch students wrestle with big ideas like that and come to terms with it.
You know? The best
thing in this conversation we had, though, was I happen to teach at DePaul University. I teach ethics at DePaul. to Catholic University.
Yeah.
And the Pope was asked the same question by a Vatican reporter. What should you give? Should you give money to a beggar outside a coffee shop? We just had this debate in class. And the Pope's response was, well, my favorite Pope, by the way, his response was, well, if you have a little money, give him a little money. If you have a lot of money, give him a lot of money. And he said, the objection was raised to the Pope. What if he buys drugs and beer? And the Pope said, it's not your money. You're not a foundation. You know, you gave it to him. Now it's his money, right? Which I love
that.
Yeah, but then the Pope said the most telling thing. And some of my students actually understood this before they heard the Pope. And that was, they said, you should look that person in the eye and speak to them respectfully. They're a human being. And you need to treat them like a human being. And they've been mistreated so long that it's worth just acknowledging their humanity, even if you don't give them money. And I thought that was really, really sweet, you know, really nice.
Yeah. Every once in a while, a good one of those comes along. Pope
said. Yeah, exactly. Well, as Stephen Colbert said when he was the faux right-wing commentator, as Stephen Colbert said, the Pope had just been elected. And he said, well, as America's foremost Catholic, of course I believe the Pope is infallible, but not this guy.
Not this guy.
So everybody has a political idea about whatever Pope we're dealing with.
So you say you're still teaching, and you're teaching at DePaul, and where else?
I teach three classes. I teach ethics at DePaul. I teach oral history taking at the University of Chicago, and I teach memoir writing at Stateville Prison. So here are my populations of students. University of Chicago, 19-year-olds, smart as hell,
right,
great academically, wealthy for the most part. DePaul, first generation of graduate students. Many of them are first generation in college, mostly in their 30s and 40s. The guys, my students at Stateville Prison, mostly in their 40s and 50s. But I'll tell you, there's something about having that range of students that keeps me mightily on my toes. The kids who were the kids at the University of Chicago are very, very, very bright, very articulate, great writers. The students at Stateville, they are not checking a box. They're not putting something on their transcript. They want to know how to write a memoir. They want their story told because nobody else is going to tell it for them. And they need the tools to tell it well. And so I find them to be the least kind of, I don't need to do anything to motivate them. They are ready to soak up all the learning they can to accomplish the task. And the task is not checking a box.
Right.
The task is telling my story.
Right. Well, so if we stopped, which we'll do soon, because I don't want to, now especially now that I found out you have three classes.
Oh, shit. I got more papers to look at than you know.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
If we stop now, what would you wish we'd talked about that we haven't?
Well, there are two things that come to my mind. You mentioned the question of violence, and I think it's worth coming back to that just for a minute. And the reason is because it's one of the things that in this history, I think gets distorted and mythologized in every direction imaginable. So I just say a quick word about it. And I guess what I'd like to say is this, that violence is, for all of us, is not entirely a choice. To the extent that it's a choice, most human beings, me included, hate violence. I don't want any part of it. It scares the shit out of me. And I don't want to be the victim of it. I don't want to be the perpetrator. Nobody likes it. And it's something that we are allergic to and should be. But the problem is that all of us are embroiled in violent social relations. And that means the violence can be invisible, but it doesn't mean that it disappears. And the clearest example in our history, although I could give modern examples, is slavery. When you lived in a slave state, and it was a violent state, and whether anybody acted that violence out in a particular farm or plantation or not, didn't matter. It was sustained by violence. It was violent to the core. Well, I would say the same is true today. A kid in Guatemala, a two-year-old in Guatemala, dying of whooping cough, avoidable, that's a violent death. It's quietly executed, and we can wash our hands of it. We can close our eyes to the world, or we can notice that not only is regular violence, like military violence and police violence, that's going on all the time, but the relations are violent even before the gun explodes. So we see now the videos of random, you know, kind of serial murders of Black young people, not all young, but mostly young. And we see it again and again. And we just saw it in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And, you know, being in Chicago, I've seen it so often. And the tragedy is that the narrative is already written. So when Laquan McDonald was murdered, 16 shots, the narrative was already in the desk drawer of the television stations and the Chicago Tribune. They pulled out the narrative and added an authenticating detail. And Laquan McDonald, date, time. But everything else was already written because that's a story we all know. The police were just patrolling and this guy violently attacked them and they shot him. Except that once the video was available, it was not true. It was the opposite. And those of us who know kind of the relationships, say, in Chicago, know that it's as likely that it not be true, more likely that that narrative not be true. So you ask yourself, what would policing look like in a free and democratic society? Or you could ask yourself, in a society that's completely hierarchical based on race and color, what does policing necessarily do? And, you know, and then you start to say, wow, I'm seeing something different. So I only say that to say that you were right in the way you raised in the beginning. That is to say, we often thought of our actions as armed propaganda. We did have a large view that we wanted to have the capacity to survive and to take the war to the war makers, but, and to defend people who are under constant attack. We never could get there, but we did carry out symbolic acts, which were kind of, political vandalism, I guess, is one way that you said it. And we tried very hard not to hurt anybody. We did kill three of our own people. And that can't be forgotten because we were playing with fire and we were burned by it. But we, you know, I don't think, here's the measure. So I started by talking about the run from 1965 to 68. We get to 68 and we open our eyes and we look around and we say 6,000 people a week are going to be murdered by our government. And there's no end in sight. 6,000 people a week. Now we know, you know, all these years later, that the war was 10 years, not 30 years, not 300 years, 10 years. And only 3 million people were murdered, not 30 million, not 300 million. So we can see it as a contained thing. But put yourself in 1968 or 69, 6,000 people are being murdered by your government. What the hell are you going to do to stop it?
Yeah.
You know, and so we felt, you know, on the same week that our organization put a small bomb in the Pentagon in a bathroom and broke some pipes that flooded a computer, which we were ecstatic about, because a computer that was managing the bombing of North Vietnam, we damaged it. And we were thrilled about that. The same week we did that, a group of American kids, very much like us, marched into a village and killed hundreds of people and all their animals and burned their crops. Who's the terrorist? Right. Who's being violent? You know, and that's where I get kind of tired of the kind of innocence that America likes to paint on itself, you know, that we're innocent and we didn't do anything. And I'm always reminded that James Baldwin said, the crime is bad enough, but the claim of innocence is an even worse crime. Mm. You know, you pretend you didn't see it or you didn't know. You knew and you saw it.
I'm glad you're calling this out. And I just want to be really clear. The finding the right language. So hopefully my language didn't suggest to you that judgment, but finding the right language for it, because it's, you know, this is going to sound insane perhaps, but you know, there are some situations that as as much as one does not want to participate in violence, there are some situations where it's almost like the just thing. I mean, you know, maybe there are people who really are, there are people who really are nonviolent and they're amazing human beings, right? They're just amazing human beings. I'm not one of them, but, you know, and so sometimes screaming and sometimes violence and sometimes push is probably the most graceful way to get out of something.
It could be. It depends on the situation. You know, this is, I do all these fun things with my students. So I said to kids last week, you know, I said, you all are against slavery, right? And there was a kind of a stunned silence. I said, wait a minute, that was an easy question. You're against slavery, right? And then they all laughed and yes, of course, we're against slavery. Good. If you were against slavery in 1855, anywhere in America, you were against the founders, the Constitution, the law, your parents, the Bible, your preacher, and we could go on. But okay, we're all abolitionists now. Good for us. And you're all for a woman's right to vote, right? Oh, yeah. But 120 years ago, if you'd been for that, you'd have been against the law, the Bible, your parents, the Constitution, the founders, blah, blah, blah. So we all know what we would do now. But what are we missing now?
Right.
That 40 years from now, if we survive, people will say, really? You lived through that and you thought that was normal? We normalize the most atrocious things. So when we talk about violence, you talk about Nat Turner, you talk about Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman's going to be on an American piece of money, apparently, at some point, right?
Eventually,
$20 bill or something, right. Yeah.
And somebody will resist.
Let's not forget that inconvenient pistol in Harriet Tubman's pocket, because there was a reason she was carrying a pistol. And it wasn't because she's a violent person or a nonviolent person. I agree with you that people who are nonviolent on principle often impress the shit out of me. And I've known several, David Dellinger very well, Dorothy Day, you know, these people do impress me. But here's the problem. And, you know, it's what we've already talked about, structures. But, you know, Gandhi, who was a complicated figure, but also who couldn't admire Gandhi. Gandhi was asked a question and answered it, a question that no Western pacifist wants to answer. He was asked by a French journalist at the end of World War II. He was asked, what about the Jews of Europe? What should they have done? And Gandhi, without missing a beat, said they should have lined up and committed mass suicide, because that would have drawn the attention of the world. And I'm like, no, you know, no, I don't think so. And I don't think that's nonviolent. I don't think that's, you know, but you don't want to commit violence, but you're killing yourself. No. And so I think we find ourselves in terrible, terrible, morally compromising positions. Bernadine and I are watching a TV series from France called A French Village. I recommend it. But one of the things that is just routine in this thing, it's about a small French village during the German occupation. It's fictional. But one of the things that's routine is when anything happens where somebody resists the Germans being there, that's terrorism. And everyone says it. Oh, the terrorists did this. The terrorists did that. Who are the terrorists? Well, they're people who, for example, blow up a German police car. Well, that is that really terrorism? How about the fact that you invaded the country? And, you know, and
it
people are...
It all depends who's telling that story.
Yeah. Well, that's what my brother always said, you know, the terrorist is what the big army calls the little army. And there is truth to that, too.
Exactly.
But we were never terrorists. And the reason we weren't is because terrorists, and I don't think the French resistance was terrorist either, because what terrorists do is they try to impact political life by terrorizing ordinary people. And that was not what we were doing, even a little. And that's mostly not what the French resistance was doing.
Right.
They were actually targeting the people who were occupying and killing them and deporting Jews and all the rest of it. And shouldn't they have done that? I think they should have. And they were not terrorists. But that's what they were called by power.
Yes.
Always. Right. They were always called terrorists.
I think your brother got it right.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. So,
well, thank you so much, Bill Ayers. Thank you so much for giving me the time and for even agreeing to stick those earbuds in your ear and and talk about the past and talk about the future and talk about your students. And
It's been nothing but a pleasure for me, David. It's a pleasure to meet you, to know about your efforts and to be a part of it. I really appreciate you.
Yeah.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.